Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has fought in various capacities in that war and with great distinction is our first guest. He is Representative Steve Russell. He represents the people of the 5th District of Oklahoma these days, but he served in the United States Army with very considerable decoration and courage for his service, notably in combat in Iraq. His unit was the one that pulled Saddam Hussein out of his spider hole. He retired as a lieutenant colonel and is now a member of the House Armed Services Committee and carrying forward the work and insights that he gleaned in uniform. Always a welcome guest here, sir. I think for the first time, good to have you back. Happy New Year to you, Steve Russell.
Well, thank you, Frank. And just for the record, I commanded one of the units involved with the Saddam hunt and capture, but my team did not pull Saddam out of the hole. However, we were on the raid.
We are grateful to you for being part of the team that brought him to justice. I'd like to start with exploring both the substance and some of the parliamentary to-ing and fro-ing that accompanied an important piece of legislation that you spearheaded earlier this year. It's called the Iran Terror Finance Transparency Act. What exactly does that act do, and what happened to it along the trail?
Well, as you know, the joint agreement, nuclear agreement that the president signed with Iran.
Or didn't sign, as the case may be,
didn't
sir.
Didn't sign, yeah. And, agreed to the agreement. It doesn't have the binding of treaty law. It's not a treaty. We agree with that. The president has stated that it is a nuclear agreement that will not affect those that are on the terror and human rights watch list. He has stated this on numerous occasions, and yet when we went through Annex 2 of the joint agreement, we found dozens and dozens of entities and individuals that were terrorists and human rights violators. So what we did with the Terrorist Financier Act, the Iran Terrorist Financier Act, is that we simply required the president to show why they now qualified for those sanctions being lifted if they were on the terror or human rights lists. He threatened to veto it. The bill is still in play. We will have the House vote on the 1st of February, I believe, weather permitting, and then the Senate will take it up after that. The president has threatened to veto it. We don't know if we'll be able to get it through both houses and to the president's desk, but it's interesting to note that just a couple of days after the sanctions were lifted, the president said that there were 11 individuals and entities who would not have sanctions lifted that were on the joint agreement. Now, that's news. And what was interesting is that all 11 of those individuals and entities were people that we had identified. We wanted a simple way to recognize who the bad actors were. And most people are not aware that you have entities like the Islamic Republican or the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps responsible for terror worldwide, responsible for thousands of soldiers' deaths, including Americans, many of them. You have General Salami and Soleimani, both of those characters responsible not only for the export of terror, but specifically for American soldier deaths in Iraq. These are not good people, and they are on the terror and human rights list, sanctions list. We felt that they did not need to come off. And so what we did is we vetted it through the Treasury Department to look at who were the individuals on the terror list and others. And we tried to make sure that we, that these indeed were bad actors, and we wanted to know why they were on these terror and human rights lists. And we identified them, put them together on a deck of cards, so that you've got their face and you've got the reason why they're on the list and why they should not be granted sanctions relief under the joint agreement. Our website at russell.house.gov, and you can also go to the Republican Conference website, and the cards are on there in PDF form. And they can also contact our office at BC for more information about the cards, but we have them out there.
Well, that's the thing. It's a brilliant marketing idea, as we've seen in the past, where you need to know who the enemy is, and we commend you for that. But give us a little bit of the state of play on this legislation of yours, Congressman. This would seem to be something that the Congress could get behind on a bipartisan basis, because
it should have been.
Yeah.
In fact, there were many. You had more than 30 or so Democratic members that voted against the Iran deal in the up or down vote. But unfortunately, when we debated this issue on the floor, the rhetoric was, well, it didn't go through the normal process. It didn't go through the Foreign Affairs Committee and blah, blah, blah. And I just laid the gauntlet down on the House floor, and I said, so it's not about experience. It's not about what's best for the country. It's about process, and it's about people's, mannerisms or whatever. I mean, that's just absurd.
Well, more to the point, this is coming. I think it's fair to say this is coming from people who have played pretty fast and loose with regular order over a long period of time.
No question. And, they weren't attacking it on its merits, and they kept quoting portions of the bill saying that that they could never under any circumstances be lifted for relief. And I pointed out repeatedly in my bill that that language simply does not exist. And so it was a very, very weak argument. They were basically, once the president said that he would threaten a veto, they lined up along partisan lines, and their vote was held together by Ms. Pelosi. And she can bring an awful lot of pressure to bear.
You nonetheless prevailed in the House, as I understand it.
Well, sure. We're going to get it out of the House with great numbers. The battle will be in the Senate, and then we're going to continue to take the fight to try to push this issue, because these are still violators of terrorism, and they're still violators of human rights. That has nothing to do with the nuke deal, so why should they get a pass?
All the more important now that the president has seen fit to go ahead and transfer, by some guesses, $100 to $150 billion, some of which even his administration has acknowledged, as you know so well, Russell of
Secretary
Oklahoma,
Kerry
in the hands of terrorists.
In the hands of terrorists. Well, duh, we've been saying this for how long? And, the sad thing about that, very highbrow view of the world is that it will result directly, Frank, in Americans' lives being lost overseas.
Yeah, indeed. Congressman, let me just quickly say that the bill went through some sort of procedural snafu, and is while it was approved, you're going to have a redo in the House, I guess, early in February, and then take the fight to the Senate. We wish you the best of luck with it, and very much hope you'll come back and talk about the efforts that will be made going forward to ensure that this important piece of legislation, the Iran Terror Finance Transparency Act, is adopted. Let me turn in the last minute we have with you very quickly, sir. The president is persisting, despite legislation that you, among others, adopted in the House Armed Services Committee's National Defense Authorization Act, to empty Guantanamo Bay, and it appears to bring at least some of its detainees here. Give us quickly your thoughts as a man who's fought these kinds of characters on the battlefields of our country.
Here's some simple facts.
Implications.
Guantanamo is a base that has been for over a century. It's vital to our national security and for the Monroe Doctrine, for helping in disaster and relief in the Caribbean. I mean, there's no way we should ever confuse Guantanamo with the whole base being shut down for terrorists. Go to the terrorist. If you bring them to the shores of the United States, they are afforded the rights under our Constitution of that almost equal to American citizens. That's a problem. That's why they're held offshore. That's why they were held in third-party countries prior to that. The president for 7 years has said that he's going to close Guantanamo, and we have stood in his way. We will do so on his eighth and final year, thank God, and he has to get past the Congress, and he's not going to be able to.
Well, from your lips to God's ears is all I can say. Congressman Steve Russell, it seems as though we may wake up one terrible day and they're here and we're stuck with a fait accompli. I pray that won't happen. It will have violated the law, but it won't be the first time. Amen. You are a fighter of the First Order. We appreciate you doing so both in uniform and now in the Congress of the United States on behalf of all of us. Keep up the great work, Congressman Steve Russell, and come back to us again if you would very soon. Peter Husey joins us next. We'll talk about nuclear deterrence and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleischer with the Center for Security Policy. The newest twist in the Hillary Clinton email scandal was the discovery of top-secret SAP material in unclassified emails on her private email server. SAP stands for Special Access Program. This was extremely sensitive information above the top-secret level, the compromise of which could cause loss of life and severe damage to U.S. national security. This was not the first report of classified information on Clinton's server. So what are the chances that hostile intelligence services hacked Clinton's email server? Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates thinks the odds are pretty high that countries like Iran, China, and Russia did hack this server. So how did this happen? The reason is that Hillary Clinton didn't think laws on official email and protecting classified information applied to her. If elected president this fall, Clinton will bring the same kind of dangerous arrogance to the White House. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Peter Husey, the president of Geostrategic Analysis, a man who has been cutting a wide swath in Washington, D.C., on Capitol Hill and in the executive branch over a very long time, notably in connection with the work that he does educating others about national security matters. Peter Husey, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. Glad to be here.
You are one of the few, maybe one of the last of the Mohicans, one might almost say, who still really understands the importance to our national security of our nuclear deterrent. You have been writing about it, thinking about it, agitating about it for all of those decades. As you look around you today, what passes for national security debate on these issues is pretty thin gruel. You have a forthcoming piece with the Gatestone Institute about two folks, Larry Korb, a former Defense Assistant Secretary, and Gordon Adams, a former OMB official, that I think properly takes the wood to them. Talk a little bit about these guys, what they're saying, and how this fits into the larger debate.
Well, what they're saying, Frank, is we're modernizing the triad at about between 1,550 and 1,800 warheads. And they say that's akin to an arms race. But the facts are we've cut 90% of our deployed warheads since the START Treaty in 1991. That's number one. Number two, they say we're spending huge amounts of money, and they extend the amount of money we spend over 30 years. I don't know anybody in Washington that does a 30-year estimate of program spending, but we spend $25 billion a year on everything nuclear out of a budget of $610 billion. You can do the math, okay? The other thing they do is, and particularly Larry Korb says, well, North Korea wouldn't test nuclear weapons or build nuclear weapons unless, if we stopped our arms race, as he calls it, they wouldn't build nuclear weapons. Well, in fact, we in the 1990s said we weren't going to test nuclear weapons. We cut nuclear weapons by nearly 50%. We basically put everything on hold in the nuclear modernization business, and North Korea did what? They cheated and lied.
Our guest is Peter Husey of Geostrategic Analysis, very much the go-to man on things nuclear these days. Peter, you were describing this notion that we're somehow forcing the North Koreans to test their nuclear arsenal and build it up. Presumably the same rationale applies to what we're forcing the Iranians to do. But I'm querying you, when people like Larry Korb and Gordon Adams point to the modernization of our nuclear forces, what exactly are they referring to, and how imminently is that likely to result in any real, you know, modernization of those forces?
What they're referring to is the planned replacement of our bombers, our ICBMs, and our submarines. We're going from 14 subs to 12. We're going to replace the 400 Minuteman, and we're going to replace some number of bombers. But here's the caveat. As Mark Schneider at the National Institute of Public Policy says, the first submarine, missile, or bomber that comes into the force is probably going to be between 2025 and 2027. By that time, Russia will have modernized every single element of its own nuclear triad, bombers, ICBMs, and subs, and submissiles. And China is building up. Pakistan is building up. North Korea is building up. In fact, we are the country that is not only building down, but we're not yet building. We're in the process of getting there. But as you know, there are a number of senators, Senator Markey and Senator Sanders, have proposed wiping out two-thirds of our triad, which Gordon Adams proposes too. Get rid of all ICBMs, take the bombers out of the nuclear business, and cut the subs from 12 to 8. That means we would only have a one-ocean navy for the Trident, either Pacific or Atlantic. So you have to choose which country you want to deter, Russia or China. And that you reduce the number of targets that the Russians would have to worry about from 500 to less than 10. I can't think of anything to make our allies go bonkers and build their own nuclear weapons, which would be more proliferation. And I can't think of anything that would look like weakness to our enemies, which might get them to use conventional forces in Ukraine or Korea or wherever you think they might do it. And you know how much that costs. So Korb and Adams have it exactly backwards.
Yeah, it's definitely pound stupid and even penny unwise. But let me ask you about where this whole issue, the importance of our nuclear deterrent, the role that it plays in maintaining stability around the world, the degree to which it prevents conventional wars, and the rest features in the broader, I say the debate. It's not been much in evidence, frankly, in the debate. Hugh Hewitt famously put some questions to Donald Trump about it without much salutary effect. But let me just ask you, are we seeing in both parties an embrace of this idea that President Obama has actually made national policy, namely that we're going to rid the world of nuclear weapons? And if so, what are the implications of a focus on that?
It's a good question, Frank. Let's take the Democratic Party. It's a useful cudgel to beat you over the head if they don't want to build nuclear weapons now. It has nothing to do with whether or not you're going to go to zero, because China said no, Russia said no, North Korea said no, Pakistan and India have said no. So the only people that said yes, maybe down the future, is Britain and the United States. So it's a cudgel to beat us over the head. On the conservative side, it's considered President Reagan did say his ultimate goal would be at some point down the road, could we get rid of nuclear weapons? But he said in the interim, I have to have a very strong nuclear deterrent. I have to have a very strong missile defense. And I have to stand up to the bad guys like he did the Soviet Union. All those things the left doesn't like. And when the conservatives and the right talk about them, we're looked at, ooh, you're a warmonger. So it's a, you know, in Washington, Frank, the issue is you don't want to do nuclear deterrence, so you say you're for zero. And if you do want to say that you're for nuclear deterrence, you kind of say, well, I'm for zero, but not now. And I think it's a sideshow. I don't think it's real. I don't think it's where we need to go and pay any attention. It doesn't help us. There's a consensus in Congress to go forward with the nuclear modernization. It is, I don't know if it's fragile, but it isn't real, real strong. And as you know, Admiral Haney recently, our STRAC commander, who is in charge of all these things in the military, he said we really have to get going and really doing the job of thinking about the issue, putting the money before the issue. And he says it's his number one issue along with cyber and counterterrorism and space. So I agree with him. And that's where we need to go. And you're right, Frank, the debate gets sidelined when you go to this Global Zero stuff. But hey, you raise a lot of money on Global Zero and then Plowshares and all these other groups. They can beat people over the head for being too pro-nuke. So that's where you are. But it basically completely detracts from the issue, which is we're spending $25 billion out of a $610 billion budget. The modernization has been long-term, long-planned. It's been delayed. We are just trying to catch up. And the Russians and the Chinese are two biggest problems. They're going gangbusters across the board in every nuclear element, and they're putting huge amounts of money in it.
But again, this would seem to me to be one of those issues on which we define the suitability of an individual to be president of the United States, that they get what you've just said, Peter Hussein said so well. And yet I'm looking at what Jeb Bush has said, which is that it's not a naive aspiration to rid the world of nuclear weapons. And I don't want to single him out necessarily, but it just does seem to me we need a real focused debate on this. You've done an extraordinary job in Washington in particular, Peter Husey, of offering platforms to those who will take these issues seriously. We need more of that. And I think arguably in the remaining days of this campaign at the debates and in the town hall meetings and so on, it's not necessarily on everybody's mind, but it needs to be. Peter, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. I have to let you go because we are hard out of time. Thank you for your time today, and let's do this again very soon. Thank you so much for joining us. Next up, we'll talk with Michael Cutler about the national security fraud and immigration straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The U.S. private sector has once again shown what free market capitalism can do through innovation at a speed utterly unimaginable for government. For the third time, American billionaires have achieved breakthroughs in access to space that promised to transform both civilian and military use of that high frontier. Jeff Bezos's Blue Origin spacecraft and Elon Musk's Falcon 9 rocket have both taken off and landed vertically. This makes possible reusable platforms for launching passengers and other payloads that can dramatically cut the costs of reliably reaching and using space. For our military, such breakthroughs could also be transformational. For example, they could provide urgently needed options for addressing a growing challenge: the prospect that enemies like communist China may be preparing to attack our assets in outer space. Being able to protect and reconstitute them is an urgent national security priority. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined once again by one of our duty experts on matters involving immigration, borders, and our security. He is Michael Cutler, a man who served with considerable distinction for a long time in the Immigration and Naturalization Services, in fact, for three decades, including as an inspector at the front line of this country's borders, the JFK Airport. He's been a criminal investigator in New York City, representative to the Unified Intelligence Division of the Drug Enforcement Agency. Today, he is a senior fellow of CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization, and a contributing editor for a marvelous website, Family Security Matters. Michael, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you.
It's a privilege. Mike, you have been warning for some time about what has been really happening to sort of the policies and programs that are designed to, well, for one thing, enforce the laws of the land with respect to immigration and naturalization and their security implications. And I'd like to talk to you about a couple of examples of really problematic stuff happening now and tease out why and who's accountable and what we should be doing about it. Let's start with the visa waiver program. It's much in the news these days. Remind us of what that is and what's being done with it.
Okay. Aliens who enter the United States are supposed to go to a U.S. embassy or consulate and apply for a visa. There's two broad categories of visas, immigrant and non-immigrant. An immigrant visa means that the alien, either because of a professional situation or because of a familial situation, is given permanent residence in the United States. It's signified by a green card. They ultimately become eligible for citizenship. They can live and work in the United States forever, unless, of course, they commit felonies or otherwise get into trouble. Non-immigrant visitors are here for a temporary period, whether they're tourists, workers, students, journalists, government officials of other governments. So they're here for a finite period of time. And 9/11 should have changed the perspective. In fact, the 93 terrorist attacks, both at the CIA and the first World Trade Center bombing, should have changed that dynamic. In fact, I did my very first congressional hearing May 20th, 1997, on the issue of visa fraud and immigration fraud, because those two issues were very relevant to those attacks. We had 9/11 because the Clinton administration abjectly ignored what should have been understood, that we've got to be careful who we're admitting. And so we had 9/11. The 9/11 Commission, to which I provided testimony, warned about tightening up the visa-issuing process. On 9/11, this country had 26 countries that participated in the visa waiver program. Since then, it has expanded to 38 countries, and now the administration is talking about adding Poland, the 39th country, to the list at a time when there should be no visa waiver program. And the pressure that's being brought to bear primarily on this program comes from the United States Chamber of Commerce. They have a program known as the Discover America Partnership, where they've partnered with the hotel, hospitality, and travel industries. This is all about revenue while throwing America's national security out the window, and politicians from both parties accepting those campaign contributions are doing the bidding of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, it's a chilling disregard for national security, and I think what you're intimating is that there's a lot of blame to go around here in both parties. But let me just keep going through this sort of bill of particulars. One of the countries that has been removed from any consideration in terms of visa waiver, as I understand it, is Iran. And yet it seems as though there's a push afoot now, I guess principally as a result of the so-called deal with Iran being implemented, that that's unfair and that we ought to, you know, now begin admitting Iranians. What do you make of that, particularly from a security perspective?
That would be an utter act of national suicide. But look, think about the Iranians that were exchanged. One of them was a guy by the name of Nadir Madanlo. This guy came to the United States in 1979 on a student visa from Iran. That was the year that our embassy was overrun in Tehran. He was admitted
by students,
to George Washington.
As so-called students.
Yes, and so we admitted him during that period. This is the Carter administration, arguably the dementor of the current president, Jimmy Carter. And this guy ultimately got an engineering degree, went to work for NASA, subsequently created his own company, and was convicted of moving secrets that enable satellites to be launched from the United States with the assistance of Russia to Iran. He was sentenced to 8 years in jail. He was sentenced to pay a significant fine of millions of dollars. This guy was allowed, or is being allowed, to return to Iran. And by the way, if
it's
my
worse
memory
than
serves
that.
Correctly, he was a citizen. He became a U.S. citizen by the naturalization process.
Well, and I think it's worse than that, Michael Cutler, because I don't think any of these guys who were so-called exchanged have actually left the country. I mean, it's just cloud cuckoo land. And now how about another of these initiatives? The president has adopted something called parole, to admit large numbers of, I gather initially at least, unaccompanied children, so-called, from Central America. What is the parole authority of the President of the United States? Are there any limits on it? And is this an abuse, as you see it, Michael Cutler, at least based on historical practice and possibly national security considerations as well?
So, absolutely, it's an abuse. You know, limited numbers, it makes sense. You know, I wrote an article for Fox News Latino way back when the president started this thing about the Dreamers, the deferred action childhood arrival. And most people, when I travel around the country, think that it deals with kids that are, you know, 15, 18, 20 years old. The Dreamers, for example, could be as old as 31. Everything that this president has done by executive action, and I said that what he called prosecutorial discretion should really be called prosecutorial deception, because these are falsehood on top of falsehood, is jamming the immigration courts We only have a few hundred immigration judges that are essential for deporting, for example, criminal aliens. These kids coming across that border right now are being bumped to the front of the line, which displaces criminal aliens who may have had their hearings ongoing. So he's really gummed up the works. He's created huge incentives for people to travel to the United States. He's putting these children at risk. He's putting communities at risk. He's creating a burdensome situation for schools, hospitals, critical infrastructure around the country to achieve a political objective. And that's why when he talked about politics during his thankfully final State of the Union address, which I said was a novel approach, novel as in fiction, he chastised politicians for playing politics. I got to tell you, I don't remember any politician, any president who's been more eager to play politics with America's national security than the current occupant of the Oval Office.
So, Michael Cutler, just to cut to the chase here, in terms of his political agenda, how would you characterize that? Is it as many of us believe that he is trying to change the demographics and therefore the political landscape of this country?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I refer to his immigration policies as instrumentalities of change for Front Page magazine. That's the only promise this president kept since he came to office. Change has indeed come to America across our borders. And he's undermining our national security and the middle class. And you name the issue, we're getting hammered. This is not a healthy situation for America or Americans.
Yeah. It's fundamental transformation, I think, is the best way to describe it. And Michael, we've got less than a minute. Republicans share some of the blame here, both, I guess, with respect to what they've done themselves and what they've allowed him to do.
Yes, they have. And look at the omnibus funding bill. I call it the ominous funding bill. It doesn't punish sanctuary cities that are guilty of harboring, obstructing, inducing, encouraging. These are felonies if you or I did them. It's giving them the money to move Syrian refugees to America. I'm Jewish. I'm a sympathetic guy where refugees are concerned. But the head of the FBI, James Comey's made it clear. There is no way to vet these people. So to bring aliens into the United States from a part of the world that cranks out terrorists quicker than McDonald's produces hamburgers, without the ability to screen them, will ultimately, I'm fearful, cost many Americans their lives.
Oh, I hope you're wrong, but I fear you're right. Michael Cutler, as always, your experiences and service to our country at the Immigration and Naturalization Services is tremendously appreciated, as is the great work you're doing at CAPS right now. Keep it up and come back to us again, if you would, very soon. We're joined next by another great American, Andrew McCarthy. We'll talk with him about taking down the New York Police Department and other travesties right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs, like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's the high point of my week. It's our visit with Andy McCarthy, the terrific former federal prosecutor turned terrific pundit and multimedia phenom, as a matter of fact. These days, he is to be found on the pages of National Review Online, PJ Media. He is frequently on Fox and so many other outlets, it's hard to keep straight. Andy, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us, sir.
Frank, thanks so much for having me.
I'd like to start with, namely, what happened when the ACLU and other leftists and Islamists, as I recalled, joined forces to take down the New York Police Department's surveillance of some of the most serious threats we're facing internally to the city and I would argue to the rest of us as well. Give us a sense of what's going on there, Andy.
Well, I think what happened, Frank, basically is that a new administration is now running New York City and the New York City Police Department, and they caved where the prior administration did not. And as a result, I think it probably as bad a time as you can imagine if we look at the ascendant jihadist threat in San Bernardino, in Paris, in Cologne, in cities across the West, and realize that New York City has always been, and I think remains, the number one target of the jihad. What they've essentially done is put blinders on the eyes of the police and the investigators who specialize in counterterrorism. Essentially, they're doing the same thing that the Obama administration imposed on law enforcement intelligence and military intelligence in the federal government. That is, they are restricting what they get to learn and apply regarding Islamic supremacist ideology on a theory, a cockamamie theory, if you ask me, that radical Islam has nothing to do with Islam.
Andy McCarthy, we have a new book coming out of the Center for Security Policy shortly that will document how what you've just described is unfortunately not unique by any means to the NYPD, that this has really been in practice now, particularly in federal agencies, both law enforcement and other national security agencies, for some time. And I just, you know, as a man who's been in this system and who has had to take advantage of the insights that are gleaned from effective law enforcement and surveillance and the cases that you can build upon such collection. Give us a flavor of what this you've I guess popularized as much as anybody this willful blindness is likely to translate into in terms of additional threats to our country.
It'll undoubtedly create the opportunity for additional attacks. Because basically what the theory is that if we show an adequate amount of what the government officials call respect to the Islamic communities, if we stop the police from proactively going into those communities and beating around the bushes in the places where we know the threats are, because we have our ear to the ground, and instead we allow our, as the Obama administration puts it, our partners in the Islamic American community, by which they mainly mean Islamist organizations, many of which are tied in some way or another to the Muslim Brotherhood. But if we allow those organizations to be our eyes and ears in the community, they'll let us know if there's anything to be worried about and all will be well. I think that's a real roll of the dice with people's security.
Well, it sadly, if it were a roll of the dice, that would be one thing. If it's the roll of the loaded dice, you've done so much in your writings to really expose the agenda of these Muslim Brotherhood front organizations. And based on what you know, for example, about the Council on American Islamic Relations or the Muslim Public Affairs Council or Muslim Advocates or the Muslim American Society or the Islamic Society of North America, I mean, these are the go-to folks in the Obama administration's outreach program. Are we dealing, in fact, with people who would be exceedingly unlikely to be helpful in stopping Islamic supremacism as they are part of that program?
Yeah, you know, Frank, as you mentioned that, it occurred to me that, you know, as you go through the litany of these Islamist organizations, who obviously have very different agendas from the United States and American national security, it occurred to me that it's really not different in principle what they do in the domestic side as they do on the foreign policy side. I mean, our catastrophic foreign policy is based on a fantasy that Iran and the United States essentially share the same interest and that they have as much of an interest in stability as we do. So we can treat them more or less like an ally, and that will improve security. And it's just a fantasy because they don't have the same agenda and they don't have the same interests. And domestically, the same thing is true here. We have an interest in security and stability. They have an interest in Sharia encroachment, which is the accommodation of Islamic law in Western societies, including ours. And you know, the problem here in a nutshell is that even the Islamic supremacists who are not themselves terrorists have an agenda that is advanced by the atmosphere of intimidation that's caused by terrorism. So they simply don't have the same incentive and the same need that we do for security, because in many ways the lack of security actually creates the atmosphere that that they profit from the most.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that civilization jihad, as you've described it in your book, The Grand Jihad, so elegantly. Andy, what you've just said is really important. In addition to popularizing, if not actually coining, the phrase willful blindness in this context, you've also, of course, introduced us to this concept of national security fraud. And it seems to me some of this really does go way beyond just not quite getting it nor having sort of fantastic illusions. It seems as though the administration has to know better, whether it's with respect to the people they're closely dealing with in the Muslim community here, or whether it's with Iran, or whether it's, you know, God only knows how many other instances you could point to, from Russia to China to Cuba and on. But when you look at this, again, from the perspective of a guy who's been seriously in the business of prosecuting fraud, among other things, criminal activities, in a previous life at least, how do you think the next president is going to have to contend with the cumulative effects of what's been done in the way of damage under very much false pretenses?
Well, a lot of it, I think, Frank, can be undone in fairly short order. And that is to say, you know, to the extent that these new policies are based on policy pronouncements by the president, executive orders, and the people that the national security agencies turn to for consultation and advice and the like, that can all be changed fairly quickly. That you, where you come in, you undo those policies and those policy pronouncements, the executive orders, and you have a different set of consultants. What's going to be very hard to unwind, I think, is career bureaucrats who have bored into the government and who are very difficult to remove in the government, and who are now placed in, you know, pretty important policy positions. So it's going to be hard to marginalize those people in the short term. It can be done in the long term, but that's the part I worry about.
Some of whom may themselves have ties to the Muslim Brotherhood. We'll see. Andy, we have to pause for just a second. You're very graciously giving us another segment of your time. We will be right back with more of the great Andy McCarthy right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where a relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined once again by Andy McCarthy, one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, a man I admire immensely and have learned extraordinary amounts from, as I think have all of us, thanks to his writings both in the periodical literature, notably at National Review Online and PJ Media, his myriad appearances in various other media platforms, but also his terrific books. And I can't do justice to all of them, but Willful Blindness, we've been talking a lot about that, The Grand Jihad, another favorite, and also most recently Faithless Execution. You can find a series of his pamphlets as well at Encounter Books. Andy, let me turn to another piece of all of this, the broad portfolio you cover. You have actually come to the conclusion that there is willful criminality involved in what was going on with Hillary Clinton's emails. That's a still unfolding story, of course, but talk a bit about what prompts you to reach that conclusion and whether you think the Department of Justice might do the same.
Well, I think, Frank, from the beginning, I have strongly suspected that there would be criminality because I thought, you know, given the level at which the Secretary of State operates, her former Secretary Clinton's initial claim that no classified information had ever passed over or been stored on her private email system seemed highly, highly implausible to me because simply because of her very, very high-ranking position, one of the two or three top positions in government, in national security, it seemed impossible that the Secretary of State could do her job exclusively, systematically on a private system and not deal with classified information. And sure enough, in short order, Mrs. Clinton had to change her talking points to no information marked classified ever came over my email system, precisely because there's plenty of classified information on her system. You know, what people don't generally understand about how this all works is if a government official who has a security clearance hears classified information at a briefing or reads about it in a classified document and then goes out and writes notes or memoranda based on the classified information, that thing that you've written is itself classified, even if it doesn't have markings on it, because it's derived from classified information. So that's illegal, too. You're not allowed to do that under the law. But we now understand that the situation is even worse. The latest reports indicate that there were actual physical documents that were doctored in a way that purged their classified markings that actually found their way onto Mrs. Clinton's system. And we have at least one email communication where she told an aide to do exactly that, to remove the markings and send something as non-classified. So that's not inadvertent. It smacks of something that's quite intentional. So it looks
that
like
that would be called, in your business, as I recall, a smoking gun, would it not?
Yeah, well, certainly if the guy acted on it, it's a crime. But even if he didn't act on it, in a pattern of behavior, it certainly shows Mrs. Clinton's knowledge and intent. And again, I would stress, this is the thing that I gave her the benefit of the doubt on at the beginning, because I know how hard it is. It's very difficult to move something from the classified government system to the unclassified system, because they're not interconnected. You actually have to make a real effort to do it. I doubted that that had happened, but evidently it has. So in other words, you and I tell you to do something illegal. Let's say you don't do it. But I've done everything I could do to bring out about the crime. I've committed attempt, even if you don't carry out the orders. If you're dealing with a statute that doesn't have an attempt provision, and not everyone does, then whether that's a crime or not really depends on whether you follow through on what I've told you to do.
Among those who apparently did that sort of cutting and pasting, Andy McCarthy, that was necessary to overcome both statutory prohibitions and the physical barriers to moving classified information. And let's be clear, some of this was exceedingly highly classified. The sorts of things that could really compromise sources and methods of intelligence, perhaps, or special access programs and even cost lives, was a woman by the name of Huma Abedin, who has been a focus of your critical eye for some time. What do we know about her emails, about her conduct, and about possible culpability in this kind of criminal behavior as well?
Well, I think to its credit, the FBI is conducting a professional investigation, which means what they know, we don't know. A lot of it hasn't made its way into the press, and that's as it should be. We do know that press reports, at least, that the focus of the investigation has come down not just on Mrs. Clinton, but on her three top aides, who were, as I understand it, both very knowledgeable about the private email system. And as we know from this email between Clinton and Jake Sullivan, who was one of these three top aides, Mrs. Clinton casually gave them directives, in this instance, to, you know, remove markings and send things that were classified as if they were unclassified. There are indications that Ms. Aberdeen, when pushed by the government officials that Mrs. Clinton ought to have a State Department account rather than be working on a private account, Ms. Aberdeen apparently said, no, that's not going to work. At least that's what's been reported. So there's certainly a lot of knowledge there. We also understand that she has a number of emails, perhaps thousands of them over this system, that haven't been released to the public yet, and that may happen imminently, and I think then we'll know a lot more.
Yeah. We'll be following that closely, as I know will you, Andy McCarthy, at PJ Media and National Review Online, among other outlets. Speaking of Huma Aberdeen, she is apparently a starring feature of a new movie about her and her husband, shot largely in the context, apparently, of his rather unseemly, shall we say, and ultimately failed candidacy for the mayor of New York. Andy, I want to go back, though, to something that you talked about in before the break, I think, and that is our efforts to work with Muslims who share our values and who are not a threat. And it seems as though, I think you agree, the dividing line between them and those who are a problem is basically adherence to Sharia. Would you just talk a little bit about the Institute for Muslim Minority Affairs, the Muslim Brotherhood established organization with whom the Aberdeen family, all of them, have been associated for quite some time, and its role in basically promoting within Western societies like ours that wrong sort of headedness in the Muslim community rather than the right?
Well, as I understand it, Frank, this journal with which Ms. Aberdeen was associated for a number of years, I think some 12 years, was a journal, and actually I think still is a journal. Her family, her mother, I believe, now runs it, but was meant to promote Sharia supremacism. I mean, I think it did it in as benign sounding a way as was possible for something that, you know, traveled under the cover of an academic journal. But the thrust of what we discussed earlier as the civilizational jihad is to integrate without assimilating in the West. And the idea is to create enclaves that are operated essentially under Muslim law and that resist Westernization. As I understand it, that was a major part of the project of this particular journal. And again, it underscores the need for us to do a better job not of resisting the idea of outreach to important Muslim groups, but to make sure that the people that we're cooperating with and turning to for consultation are the right Muslims, which means a pro-Western, assimilated Muslims who, you know, whose first agenda item is the national security of the United States, not the promotion of Islamic law.
Yeah, and taking down, among other things, the national security of the United States. Andy, your insights on all of these issues are simply indispensable, certainly to us and our audience, and I think to the wider world. Keep up the great work, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.